From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I continue to believe in the United Nations and in our staff, many of whom have made the ultimate sacrifice.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon delivering his year-end address at UN headquarters in New York Wednesday.
I continue to have faith in the ability of the world's people to come together for the common good, as just demonstrated so emphatically in Paris. With that spirit, we can make 2016 a year of accomplishment and truly build a life of dignity for we the peoples. I thank you. Merci beaucoup.
Secretary Ban spoke about North Korea, Burundi, migration, and his own legacy, among other topics. His comments on Syria appeared to indicate that he was coming closer to Russia's position on the crisis in that war-torn country.
Basically, in principle, it's up to the Syrian people who should make a decision about the future of President Assad. But at the same time, I also believe that it is unacceptable that the whole this Syrian crisis and solution to this crisis has to be depending upon just a question of fate of one man. That's not acceptable. But that's why people have been discussing this matter all the times. But I leave it to the parties concerned to discuss this matter again in parallel, try to finding out political space as well as delivering humanitarian assistance. In transition, in the course of transition, there may be some countries are now expressing there's some nuanced positions that there may be some role or need for President Assad to stay just a limited month, but that will have to be decided later on.
Those comments followed a gathering of a new Saudi-led coalition in Riyadh that called for the ouster of Assad, a call that was rejected by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
With respect to the announcement or proclamations of the people who came together in Riyadh, that is not the position of the International Syria Support Group. It is not the basis of the Geneva Communique. It is not the basis of the UN resolution. And we are assured by the members of the International Syria Support Group who were attending that meeting and helping with that meeting and hosting that meeting, that is not, in fact, the starting position, because it's a non-starting position, obviously.
And in his comments at the UN on Wednesday, Secretary Ban expressed his position about the newly formed group led by Saudi Arabia.
I read that report that Saudi Arabia has initiated to form a Muslim country-led coalition. As you know, this coalition led by Western countries, including Russia, they have been operating the military operations to fight against this terrorism. And I sincerely hope that when there is a coalition formed, I think that they should very closely coordinate with other countries who are already participating in coalition. As I again said, it's very important when they stage military operations, there should be extreme care and efforts not to harm any civilian population and civilian facilities. And this is a fundamental principle of international human rights and humanitarian law.
At his joint press conference with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Secretary Kerry himself sounded like he had moved very close to the Russian position.
As I emphasized today, the United States and our partners are not seeking so-called regime change, as it is known, in Syria. What we have said is that we don't believe that Assad himself has the ability to be able to lead the future Syria, but we didn't, we focused today not on our differences about what can or can be done immediately about Assad. We focused on a process, on the political process, whereby Syrians will be making decisions for the future of Syria.
Those comments made by Secretary Kerry in Moscow on Tuesday set off a feeding frenzy at the Department of State's regular press conference on Wednesday.
That Fred.
I wanted to start with Syria. Can you explain at this point how the U.S. position on Assad is different from Russia's position on Assad, on Assad's future?
Well, I'm not going to talk for Russia and what they feel is Assad's place. What I can tell you is, it just wouldn't be appropriate.
Well, you talk about Russia a lot with Assad, that their military.
But you're asking me to. Okay, you're asking me to describe their policies, and I won't do that. But what I will say is that nothing has changed, and we've talked about this before. Nothing's changed about our view that Assad cannot be the future of Syria, that you can't have a unified, whole, pluralistic, non-sectarian Syria where people feel safe and secure and can stay home or go home with Assad still in power. And we've said that from the very beginning.
Well, no, not from the very, very beginning. I think in 2011, if we stroll back down memory lane, President Obama said, the time has come for Assad to step aside. He didn't say step aside in the future, step aside at one undetermined day according to mutual consent when he feels ready. It was he had to leave immediately. And there's been countless examples since. Now, I understand there's been an evolution in your thinking, but yesterday it seemed to go a little farther in that the secretary said, we see Syria fundamentally very similar, talking about the U.S. and Russia, and the only thing he pinpointed was a U.S. belief, and that was his word, that Assad should leave one day, not a U.S. policy with a strategy for implementing that.
Well,
so can you explain when this latest shift toward belief came into play and when you sort of kind of gave up on getting him out immediately?
Nobody's given up on the notion that Assad has to go. And that has remained our policy for a long time. And we could quibble over words and rhetoric, but nothing has changed about our view, our belief, that Assad cannot be the future of Syria, and that if we're going to meet the Geneva communique, and if we're all going to strive to get to a unified whole Syria through a transition that's Syrian-led and that includes the voice of the Syrian people, I don't think anybody rationally can think that even in the minds of most Syrians, that Assad is the right leader for the country. So nothing's changed about our view that he has to go. But the secretary has said, and he's been saying it for quite a while, I could pull you the quotes and the dates that he said it, is that as we work through this process, it's more important for us that the end result is a government away from Assad and towards one that is respectful of and responsive to the Syrian people, not necessarily that he goes on day one or week one or month one of the process. I'm not aware of an evolution here in thinking. We still remain committed to Assad's departure. Again, we're also mindful in this process, the Vienna process, that not everybody in the international community, certainly not everybody even in the ISSG, has exactly the same views with respect to Assad's future, which is why it's so important to keep meeting and why it's so important to keep having these discussions. I've seen press coverage that would indicate that, you know, we've gone through some metamorphosis or some transformation, that we're all of a sudden taking the Russian view, and it's just not so.
I have one more along similar lines. The Geneva communique from 2012, which you say undergirds this whole process, immediately after that was reached, Secretary Clinton at the time said that meant Assad and his cronies, those were her terms, couldn't be part of the unity government because of mutual consent. He wouldn't be able to be part of the unity government. Yesterday, Secretary Kerry said the notion of Assad leaving immediately was a non-starter. I just wanted to know, how does it help the opposition that you're supporting when, you know, their number one backer says that their opening stance is a non-starter?
Well, there's a lot that helps the opposition here. First, that they got together at all, which I seem to be one of the only few here in the briefing room that thinks that this is significant, that you got 116 participants in the opposition together in one room to talk about –
This has happened before as well.
To talk about the future of Syria and to actually come together, and I don't think it has happened before, that they came together with a set of a dozen unifying principles. Now, these are their views. They are not necessarily representative of the views of every other member of the ISSG. This was a meeting of the opposition groups convened by Saudi Arabia. The ISSG has already spoken to this issue many times, and you've seen it in the communiques coming out of Vienna. And so the secretary was absolutely 100% right when he said that in the view of the international community embodied in the ISSG, the notion that he has to go immediately or on day one, however you want to phrase it, that is a non-starting position in the view of the ISSG. So we recognize that. So we recognize that as a body, the ISSG may have or has a different sense of what a political transition might look like than the group of opposition groups. So what does that tell you? That there's still more work to be done, that there's still differences to solve, that there are still debates and discussions and negotiations that have to occur. And that's why it's so important to get together on Friday in New York to have these sets of meetings.
John, just to follow up very quickly, when the secretary says it's a non-starter, he's talking about the launching or the beginning of the negotiations, correct?
He's talking about their view that
right.
that was expressed in that right. communique that at the beginning
okay.
of the that before the negotiations process. Can begin, right. Assad has
okay.
to depart.
So he's not conditioning the beginning of the negotiations with Assad's departure. But is there an understanding that at the end of this process, Assad will have to be gone?
There's an understanding that
right.
we have to get to a government
right.
that is responsive mm-hmm. and representative of the Syrian people. Obviously, that's not the Assad regime. There's an understanding, and it's all laid out in the communique, that this transition to that government has to be Syrian-led and has to include the voices of the Syrian people, which would convey that also Assad's not going to be at the end. And we have said consistently, and we're not the only nation inside the ISG who has said this, that Assad can't be part of the future of Syria. But we have said the manner in which he goes, the when, the how, the where to, all of that has yet to be decided, which is why it's important to continue this process.
Okay, I just want to follow up on Brad's point, because we all remember when Secretary Clinton said that Assad and his cronies. What is meant by cronies? Are we talking about the regime? Are we talking about the whole apparatus? Is it similar to Iraq? Because there was also an open letter sent out by your last envoy to Syria, Robert Ford, saying that it's not only Assad, but also those close to him and so on. So we're beginning to see that, you know, the demand for Assad's departure may include the government or the system or the security services or the army, bring in a situation similar to that of Iraq.
Well, I'm not going to be able to list for you
right.
who or who isn't a quote-unquote crony.
Right.
Obviously, there are people close to Assad and deeply loyal to him, who are complicit in the atrocities that he's perpetrating against his people. And I assume, you have to assume, that will be part of these discussions, who they are and what their future is too. I don't want to get ahead of that. But what the secretary has also said is, as we work through this transition, it's important that the institutions of government, the functioning institutions, the institutions that the people of Syria are going to need to continue to rely on, need to stay in place. That so whether it's economic, educational, perhaps even military, some of those institutions have got to stay in place. But what they look like, who leads them, how they're administered going forward, all of that's going to be part of the negotiations, which is why it's so important to get the parties together as early in the next year as possible. I just couldn't tell you exactly what that's going to be right now. That's why it's important to keep having these meetings.
And my last point is on the opposition. The latest reports suggest that the Free Syrian Army, which you invested so much in, is basically collapsing. People are, you know, joining, defecting and joining other groups and so on. And that is the most moderate group. I mean, listening to the debate last night, it was quite enlightening. Some of the debaters were saying, who are these moderate opposition groups that you keep talking about? Who are they?
I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I'm certainly not going to parry and thrust campaign rhetoric. I won't do that. We've long said the opposition groups are fluid and that people do come and go. We've admitted that even in some opposition groups, people can develop over time extreme views that no longer represent the moderate views of the opposition group that they joined. It's a fluid, dynamic environment. We understand that. But we also recognize that there are lots of moderate opposition groups. And to answer your question, look at what happened in Riyadh last week. There's your answer. There's your moderate opposition. 116 participants of the opposition got together to talk about the future of Syria and what they want to see out of this political process. So to deny that there's a moderate opposition, I think, just belies the facts. Since we had a big meeting in Riyadh, and we recognize it's a fluid situation. But it doesn't mean that a moderate opposition doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean, and you don't have to look any more than closer than the communique that came out of Riyadh to see that they are capable of unifying around some core principles, and they're capable of deriving for themselves those negotiating points that they feel are important to take forward.
You consider Harar al-Sham a moderate opposition?
There's a process going on right now that's going to work through this. The Jordanians are leading. We've talked about this group in the past. We've been honest about the concerns that we've had about some of their behavior.
But they were at the Saudi conference.
They were.
They're so moderate that you've never given them any material assistance
they
at
were,
all.
That conference was convened by the Saudis. I've said before, we did not get into, we provided our input. And the Saudis convened this group, the conference. The work about who is going to be able to move forward in a political process is still being done by Jordan. We need to wait to get the results of that.
You just described them as the moderate opposition.
I said that if you look, and all you have to do is to deny that there is a moderate opposition, which was the premise of the question.
Okay.
All you have to do is look at what happened in Riyadh to see that there is, in fact. I didn't go through the list of every single group that was invited to Saudi make a determination.
Some in Riyadh were moderate. That's your position.
Absolutely.
Okay.
What constitutes success for you on Friday?
Well, there's two components to Friday, and I kind of alluded to this in the opening statement. The morning will be another round of the ISSG. It will be roughly the same 20 participants that participated in Vienna. At least that's the going in work that's being done, and those are the same participants being invited. And so the goal there is to continue to try to better define what we think the political transition and the process itself should look like, to try to put more fidelity on the notion of a ceasefire, and again, how that would be monitored and implemented, and to have, for the benefit of the whole group, a chance to learn more about what happened in Riyadh, to sort of read that out and make sure that everybody has a common sense of understanding about that. Then in the afternoon, meetings at the UN, the goal there is to arrive at a resolution, a UNSC resolution, that codifies the very process that we've been talking about under UN auspices. We talked about a little bit about this yesterday. The pieces of that would be, again, a political transition, describing that process, the process that was laid out in Vienna about the, you know, the six-month talks between the opposition and the Assad regime, and then the 18 months subsequent to get at the drafting of a constitution, but to codify all that, as well as hopefully and potentially codify some framework pieces about a ceasefire.
What does getting more fidelity on the notion of a ceasefire mean?
Well, I think, you know,
more clarity or
a deeper sense of understanding of what that would look like and how it would, I mean, how it would be implemented, monitored, you know, how it could be most successful. I mean, there's a lot of, as you well know, Arshad, I mean, ceasefires are complicated things, and they're complicated things to keep track of. They're complicated things to see succeed. And so obviously that's going to be all the more so in a place like Syria. So there's lots of details that have to be hammered out about that.
Do you want to have monitors on the ground?
Again, those are the kinds of modalities that I think need to be fleshed out.
Well, given how loath most governments have been to committing troops to ground troops to Syria, what makes you think that governments would be willing to have monitors on the ground? Or is that just off the table?
No, I don't think we're at the stage now where we're ruling anything in or out in terms of monitoring. It's important that just like the political process, we'd want the ceasefire to be under UN auspices. And the UN has a history of monitoring ceasefires in the past. But how that would be done, with what resources to include manpower, I think we couldn't possibly answer that question for you. I mean, that's part of why it's important to continue these discussions.
John, just quickly to follow up on this composition of the new Islamic front that is led by Saudi Arabia with so many different countries, I conspicuously exclude Iraq and Syria, which are in the forefront in the fight against ISIS. Is that logical or illogical in your judgment?
I think you should talk to the Saudi government here about this decision that this coalition that they've talked about. This was led by Arab states.
On Wednesday, the U.S. Federal Reserve announced that it was raising the federal funds rate from a range of 0% to 0.25% up to a range of 0.25% to 0.5%. The move was hailed by some as evidence of a strengthening economy. However, not everyone, including not all economists, think it's a good thing. Some believe it could actually damage any chance of a recovery. Among those is Professor Richard Wolff. We spoke with him via Skype Thursday. Dr. Wolff, welcome. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don. Glad to be here.
So, yesterday, the Fed announced that they're going to allow the Fed funds rate to go up from the current range of 0% to 0.25, now 0.25 to 0.5. And oddly, usually historically the stock market falls when interest rates go up, the stock market went up, although admittedly we haven't had an increase in interest rates since 2009.
Well, I think there are two key things to keep in mind to situate this properly. The first is that they had been telling everyone in the stock market, both the American stock market and global stock markets, that they were going to do this. They've basically been signaling that for months now, and assuring everybody not only that they would do it, but that they would not necessarily raise it further, that they would watch very carefully to see if this proved to be problematic, and that if it did, they would not hesitate to stop raising them or even to lower them the little bit that they still could do before getting to zero or negative territory, which they say they don't want to do. So I think the one-day stock market reaction is mainly a wait and see. We're not sure what this is going to mean or how this is going to work and what the effects will be. You never do when interest rates go up. Even when they raise them and the stock market goes down, that can often be reversed within one or more days afterwards. And I think we're going to have to see how this plays out. The second is the more historical context. The United States is simply not the dominant player in the world economy the way it once was. And that means what the Federal Reserve does here, while important and global in its implications, is simply not the final word. The Chinese are now a major player. Europeans remain a major player. The third world taken together, or what we used to call the third world, is now a major player. And there are conflicting crosswinds that could change all of these things, whether it be the crazy collapse in the oil market or who knows what political shifts, the elections in Spain this weekend. There's a longer list than I could mention. And what is causing the stock market to move are all of these variables and more. And you can't really link it to the Federal Reserve beyond a very small part. And that applies as well to the long-term impacts of this small change in interest rates. So I think you have to keep the larger perspective in mind before you run off and then, on this subject.
Right. And then, you know, what we're looking at only an increase up to a half a percentage point. In terms of a return on investors' money, interest rates, you know, savings, CDs, all of those things are still just not competitive, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's even more important to recognize that the whole point of what they did is to raise rates, not just for overnight federal funds markets, but in general, to give an upward bias, let's call it, to interest rates. And let's be real clear what that means. For the vast majority of Americans who have yet to recover in a meaningful economic sense from the collapse of 2007, 8, and 9, this means that their credit card debt will be more burdensome because the rates will inch upwards, even if they don't go beyond the small raise of today, that it will be harder and more expensive to buy a car, to buy a home. In other words, life is going to become more expensive for people who have no slack to absorb that kind of thing. And they ought to wonder, the mass of Americans, for example, having been badly whipsawed, victimized first by the collapse of a system that they had nothing to do with, basically. They didn't cause this collapse. No one in their right mind would argue that. Then they suffered from to see that the bailouts that were suddenly forthcoming in 2008 and 9 went to the biggest corporations who had much more to do with bringing this crisis than anything the mass of Americans did. And then they saw various kinds of austerity imposed in the United States, re-raising the payroll tax, the sequester, and all the other cuts of government programs. And now, at the end of what took 8 years of a failed recovery that should have taken 8 months and has in the past sometimes gone quickly. This one took a long time, bypassed the mass of the people, and now the Federal Reserve says, oh, and by the way, we're so frightened by the amount of money we created to keep this system going, they are now taking a step back by raising interest rates. It may correct some of the excess money creation that they perform, but it comes at the cost of burdening an already overwrought and upset mass of people at what they've gone through. It promises to hurt the economy by cutting public demand for all kinds of things. It is, to be as kind as I know how, a highly problematic policy step following a long list of policy errors who can only claim that they prevented it from being even worse a lost decade than the one it actually is.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.